Welcome to Asia Pacific Review. I'm Adam Connors. Coming up, Pakistan admits for the first time that the surviving gunman from the Mumbai attacks is a Pakistani citizen. Hundreds injured as several massive quakes hit Indonesia's Papua region. And the US president signs off on the creation of new marine reserves in the Pacific. But first, and as we've seen over the last week across Asia, fighting between Israel and the Palestinian authorities has forced people onto the streets. There have been demonstrations in the Thai capital, Bangkok, where protesters staged a rally outside the Israeli embassy. And thousands also gathered outside the US embassy in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. Professor Hayadi Wirawan is the director of the Department of International Relations at the University of Indonesia. He told Zulfikar Abani that most of the protesters are Muslim who see the Middle East conflict as an attack on Islamic society.
Most Indonesian Muslims are so stood up and they have shown their solidarity, and it caused a big fanfare in Indonesia.
And it is predominantly Muslims, isn't it, who are protesting?
Yes.
In both Indonesia and Thailand?
That's true. It's mostly those involved in that demonstrations in Thailand are people of the southern province of Surat Thani, which are most of them Muslims. So it is very much against the Israelis as depicted as a Zionist state, and against America as the sole supporter of Israel. And in many Indonesians also, mostly Muslims, describe these Americans are neocons, or what is inspired by the hardcore Christians. Yes, there's a big problem here in Indonesia now.
But some of the people in Indonesia are calling on the government to even send troops to Gaza to defend the Palestinians, and others are even suggesting just sending their own people to go and fight in Gaza. Should the Indonesian government, while it might not respond too much, but should it be concerned about that people are willing to get up and fight in Gaza?
They have been advised by Indonesian government not to go to Gaza, apart from the fact that they are not experienced, but the underlying is that they will create more problems than otherwise, because most of the people are so much emotional that they don't have any skills that can be used to fight the Israelis. But apart from that, what has been encouraged by government is if they could donate something that will be helpful for the Palestinians at large, and it could be the government will perhaps help them some way to send them over to Palestine.
As an aid, more like in an aid function.
That's true. But of course, the government will discourage anyone who would like to go to Gaza, because it will stir up also the extreme elements within the society to wage a different kind of war within the Indonesia itself, then it will endanger most foreigners living in Indonesia, especially the Western expatriates.
This has happened before, hasn't it? During the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict, the Indonesians also suggested that perhaps they should go and fight in the Middle East. What do you think it says to the international community that there are people in Indonesia who are willing to and want to go and fight in other people's conflicts?
Yeah, the problem with them are that first, they are lacking of information. Secondly, they've been stirred up by most of these Arabic news sources. They've been also encouraged by the radical clerics in Indonesia. So without enough information, they've been very emotional because it is described as an attack to the Islamic society. But actually, they don't have enough information about what is actually happening. They don't really care about the causes and the true politics of the Middle East.
Professor Hayadi Wirawan, who's the director of the Department of International Relations at the University of Indonesia, speaking there to Zulfikar Abani from Jakarta. The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has ramped up tensions with Pakistan by accusing Islamabad of direct involvement in November's terrorist attacks on the city of Mumbai. For its part, Pakistan has denied India's allegation, although it has admitted for the first time that the sole surviving gunman from the Mumbai attacks is a Pakistani citizen. This report from South Asia correspondent Sally Sara in New Delhi.
More than a month after the Mumbai terrorist attacks, the tension between India and Pakistan continues to escalate. Now the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is directly accusing Pakistani government agencies of involvement in the violence. Mr. Singh believes the attacks were so carefully planned and executed that government agencies must have played a part.
There is enough evidence to show that given the sophistication and military precision of the attack, it must have had the support of some official agencies in Pakistan.
The Indian Prime Minister is calling on the international community to isolate Pakistan. He accuses the Pakistani government of using terrorism as a state policy.
States that use terrorism as an instrument of foreign policy must be isolated and compelled to abandon such tactics.
On Monday, the Indian government released a dossier of evidence which it says proves the attackers were from Pakistan. The Indian media has been broadcasting reenactments of alleged transcripts of the terrorists and the hostages.
Hello. Grenade phenko.
Unhone kaha hai ki wo aapse sampark karenge.
Theek hai, fikr na karo.
The Indian media's intense coverage of the aftermath of Mumbai has angered and alarmed the Pakistani government. The government denies any involvement in the bloodshed and says India is yet to produce any firm evidence. Malik Ahmad from the Pakistani Ministry of Foreign Affairs says India needs to provide proof.
Because we also have asked them to provide us concrete evidence, it will only help us in going into the details of the investigation, and we are constantly asking them to share whatever evidence they have.
While Pakistan faces hostility on its border with India, President Asif Ali Zardari has been dealing with urgent security concerns with another neighbour, Afghanistan. Mr. Zardari has met with his Afghan counterpart Hamid Karzai in Kabul. The two leaders say they have a new relationship and determination to fight terrorism. Later this week, US Vice President-elect Joe Biden is expected to visit the region. The Obama administration will inherit the challenges of trying to build relationships with governments while dismantling the groups accused of destabilising Afghanistan, Pakistan and India.
Sally Sara reporting there from New Delhi. Emergency teams are continuing to assess the damage after Indonesia's Papua region was struck by a series of massive earthquakes during the week. At least five people died and up to 250 have been injured in the main towns of Manokwari and Sorong. The United Nations says around 14,000 people are now in temporary shelters, many of them too frightened to return home. They say hundreds of homes and dozens of government buildings, schools and places of worship have been destroyed. Christine Webster reports.
During the early hours of Sunday morning, Indonesia's Papua region was hit by at least 40 quakes or aftershocks. The initial quake, which had a magnitude of 7.2, was followed by a second quake with a magnitude of 7.6. According to emergency and aid workers, it was the second quake which caused the most damage. World Vision's communications officer for the Papua region is Enda Valina.
From what I saw on my way from the airport to the downtown here, I saw some buildings collapsed, including two hotels, Kalidingin Hotel and Mutiara Hotel, that are very heavily damaged. And also I saw in almost every house, the community set up tents in front of their houses and they stay there. And also, I saw some displacement camp, like where I am at the moment.
Dr. Priyadi Kadono from Indonesia's Natural Disasters Centre for Data, Information and Public Relations says while the Papua region is prone to earthquakes, the seismic events that occurred on Sunday were rare.
It is unusual in Indonesia because for the first, usually a big one, and after the big one, there will be a small earthquake.
World Vision's Enda Balina says Indonesia's Department of Social Affairs has already set up tents for those too afraid to return home because of fears of aftershocks and tsunamis.
They're still very afraid with the earthquakes, apparently, and most of them still choose to stay outside of their house instead of going back home. But fortunately, the electricity already returned last night, and also the telephone line is much better, and especially the airport, which already being reopened this morning.
Ms. Bellina says as well as the assistance being provided by the Indonesian government, World Vision is also providing tarpaulins and blankets.
The tarps just arrived, so we hope we can distribute them soon. And in Jayapur office we have around 1,800 emergency kits ready on standby. But we still need to wait until we've done with the assessment process to find out if those emergency kits are still needed or the government is able to cover the disaster.
World Vision's communications officer for the Papua region, Enda Bellina, ending that report by Christine Webster. From the Melbourne studios of Radio Australia, you're listening to Asia Pacific Review. The Sri Lankan government has been celebrating the capture of the Tamil Tigers' de facto capital, Kilinochchi. But military observers say there may be bloodier battles still ahead, with the rebels taking refuge in the jungle. Sonia Heidemann reports.
Sri Lankan troops captured the unofficial capital of the Tamil Tigers and urged the rebels to lay down their arms and end their decades-old struggle for a separate homeland. The Sri Lankan government called the army's capture of Kilinochchi an unparalleled victory for the entire nation. Dr. Palita Kahona, Secretary of the Sri Lankan Foreign Affairs Ministry, says claiming Kilinochchi is a significant achievement.
I think this is a major setback for the LTTE because they've lost their administrative centre. We would expect it to have a huge demoralising effect on them as well.
Taking Kilinochchi is the culmination of a major military offensive that began in March 2007 and has involved daily fighting for at least 9 months. And while losing Kilinochchi is a major setback, the Tigers have shown in the past they have the ability to rebound from even the most dire situations. Barely 6 months after government troops captured the northern Jaffna Peninsula in 1995, the Tigers overran a military base in the northeastern district of Mulay Tivu, killing more than 1,200 soldiers. The guerrillas also reversed military gains of 19 months in a matter of 5 days in November 1999, going on to dislodge the military from their Elephant Pass base at the entrance to Jaffna. Dr. Kahona says that the circumstances this time are very different.
The Sri Lankan army is well-led, well-motivated and well-armed. That's extremely important. On top of that, unlike on previous occasions, Tigers are now banned as a terrorist organization in almost every democracy in the world. It's not that easy for them to seek political support or funding support from overseas. Whatever they do is done in an illicit manner. So it's going to be very difficult for them to bounce back.
United Nations agencies and other international aid groups previously had offices in Kilinochchi, but pulled out late last year at the government's request as fighting escalated in the region. Jivan Tiagaraja is executive director of the Consortium of Humanitarian Agencies in Sri Lanka. He says the delivery of aid still isn't possible.
In terms of conventional humanitarian assistance, it is a non-starter for the time being with shifting front lines and also with no real guarantee of security. There have been reports that the government is expecting a large movement south of the people who have moved away from Kilinochchi to a town called Mulay Tivu. Those are to be seen. We would clearly remain concerned in terms of how one deals with the shifts as well as the needs of the people who are, in a sense, I think, trapped in this theatre.
Jivan Tiagaraja, Executive Director of the Consortium of Humanitarian Agencies in Sri Lanka, ending that report by Sonia Heidemann. United States President George W. Bush has signed off on the creation of 3 new marine reserves in the Pacific. President Bush used the U.S. Antiquities Act to create the reserves as national marine monuments, which means their status as protected areas is instantaneous. But as Pacific correspondent Campbell Cooney reports, while the move has been applauded by conservation groups and scientists, not everyone is pleased.
With less than a fortnight left in office, US President George W. Bush opened the ceremony which created the new marine reserves with a nod to history.
It's interesting that we're gathered a few steps away from the office once occupied by a young Assistant Secretary of the Navy named Theodore Roosevelt. Not long after he left the position, he was back on these grounds as the 26th President of the United States. And exactly 100 years ago, he embarked on his final weeks as a president. Something I can relate to. Under the Antiquities Act that Theodore Roosevelt signed in 1906, the president can set aside places of historic or scientific significance to be protected as national monuments. I am using that authority.
The new marine monuments cover the areas around the Northern Marianas, including the Marianas Trench, the island groups south of Hawaii, and Rose Atoll, which is near American Samoa. The director of the Washington-based Global Ocean Legacy Campaign, Jay Nelson, has told Corinne Podger within those areas are some of the most rich and diverse natural marine environments in the world.
All these areas have populations of sea turtles. 14 million seabirds use the Central Pacific Islands, either for breeding or nesting or, in some cases, migration. In the Northern Mariana Islands, the Mariana Trench, there's only been one survey done for marine mammals. They found 19 species of marine mammals there, which is a phenomenal number, including the bottlenose whales, which are a very rare and really kind of an unknown group of animals.
But President Bush was keen to remind his audience while the new monuments would mean limits on commercial exploitation within them, it would not mean a ban on visiting them or traveling through them.
The monuments will prohibit resource destruction or extraction, waste dumping, and commercial fishing. They will allow for research, free passage, and recreation. They will ensure full freedom of navigation and include measures to uphold training missions and other military operations.
But the new monuments have not been welcomed by everyone. Madeline Bordallo is the Guam representative in the U.S. House of Congress, and Guam's proximity to the Marianas Trench and its islands has led the Congresswoman to release a statement voicing her displeasure at the process which led to the creation of a national monument so close to her constituency.
I do not believe that this process was as inclusive and consultative as we would have preferred. I remain concerned about the effect of this monument designation on local sovereignty.
Radio Australia requested an interview with Congresswoman Bordallo to find out exactly why she feels the creation of the reserves will adversely affect local sovereignty in what is a United States territory. Her office informed us her diary was full.
And I would like those who have been assigned the task of standing up here to join me as I sign the national monuments.
The creation of the new reserves comes less than a fortnight before President Bush leaves office, and there are claims he's only done it to improve his legacy on environmental issues in future years. Jay Nelson says while there might be some truth to that, he personally doesn't believe President Bush is only thinking about his place in history.
The president and everyone in the administration is aware that it will be viewed favorably in history, and clearly the environmental community has given him a lot of trouble over many of his decisions. But, you know, when a decision is made by the president that's a good one, you know, it's our responsibility and our obligation to applaud it.
The director of the Washington-based Global Ocean Legacy Campaign, Jay Nelson, ending Campbell Cooney's report. The Prime Minister of Japan, Taro Aso, has admitted for the first time that Allied prisoners of war from Australia and the Koreas, as well as Dutch and British POWs, were used as forced labourers in his family's mining company during World War II. Former Australian POWs who worked in the mines say they welcome the acknowledgement, but are calling for a full apology from the Japanese leader. Barbara Miller reports.
Taro Aso was a child during World War II. When asked previously about the use of POWs in Aso mining, he said he had no recollection of the time. In 2006, when Taro Aso was foreign minister, the ministry described as unreasonable media reports that POWs were used as forced labourers in the family's company. But after being pressed in Parliament by a member of the opposition, Mr. Aso said his position has now changed. The Prime Minister said a recent government inquiry had revealed that Allied prisoners of war had been used as forced labourers by Aso Mining. Several hundred British, Dutch and Australian POWs are thought to have been forced to work in the mines. Among them was Joe Coombs, who now lives in Sydney. He says it was tough and dangerous work.
The coal mines were the worst of the lot. I'm sure the mines that we were working in were old mines that had been reopened, and the coal that we were taking out should have been left there to hold the mine together. and we had several major falls while we were working there.
Jo Kum says the acknowledgement from Taro Aso should have come sooner, but says he would like an apology now.
Oh, yes. I'd certainly would welcome anything that they'd... acknowledgement would be at least something. An apology would be very small price to pay for what they did.
Arthur Giger from South Australia also welcomes Taro Aso's turnaround.
I'm just pleased to find that they have at last admitted it, because they've been denying it all along.
But Arthur Giger says it's too late now for an apology.
It doesn't mean anything, really. Not to me, it doesn't. I know what happened, and I knew the truth. In spite of all the denials, I knew.
Jack Hall was also forced to work for Aso Mining as a POW. His daughter Marilyn wrote to Taro Aso a few years ago, asking for an apology for her father's treatment. She never received a response, but is hopeful one might come now. She says it would mean a lot to her father. He's in a nursing home now in central west New South Wales and will celebrate his 90th birthday on Friday.
I'd love to hear a response. I'd love to get a response from Mr. Aso. In fact, I was going to sit down and write to him again. I'd love to hear from him and just to show it to my dad before he died, and just say, look, Dad, these people have recognised that what you went through was pretty tough and it was wrong, and I'm sure that would make him feel so peaceful.
Marilyn Caruana, whose father Jack Hall was a prisoner of war in Japan in World War II. And finally, an attempt to involve young Solomon Islanders in sporting activities rather than violent ones is paying off. A team of young soccer players from the Solomons dominated the early stages of the Australian Indoor Soccer, or Futsal, Championships in Canberra. Catherine McGrath has the story.
They're young, tough and talented. Captain Alex Waymora's goal is to play soccer one day in the World Cup.
I've trained so hard to come to compete in this tournament. Well, it's my privilege indeed, so I train as much as I can.
And he might just make it. In the world of soccer, the Solomon Islands teams are strong.
Solomon Islands teams have been coming for almost 10 years now, and they use that as a gauge of how they're doing. I suppose they're the Brazil of the South Pacific, and they themselves just represented Oceania at the World Cup.
After 2 days of competition in Canberra, Alex's team is undefeated in the 14-year age division at the Australian Futsal Championships. Soccer is played all over the Solomon Islands, but usually on rough surfaces with only basic equipment. These players have benefited from a campaign introduced 6 years ago to boost sport as a counter to some of the violence young people have seen around them in the last decade. And so a structured futsal development program was introduced through a church-based international aid group and local sports authorities.
We went back in the year 2002 and started development. In the Solomon Islands, there's now thousands of kids playing.
Pastor Brian Codrington is a Baptist minister and founder of the futsal program.
It's given them something to do. There's still a lot of mischief that happens around the Solomon Islands, and so giving kids something to do is the first important part, but then we want to build on that as well.
Competing at the top level means travel, according to team coordinator Pastor Nathaniel Seru.
It's very, very important, especially giving them confidence so that they can, when they come to international level, they have the confidence to play in the international level.
Today's victory secured after beating the Canberra team 3-2, Alex and his teammates were off to Parliament House to capture some of the local history. Catherine McGrath, Canberra.
And that ends this week's edition of Asia Pacific Review. I'm Adam Connors, and thanks for your company.